So I changed the title just a bit, having been here for 2 weeks, and I thought that a title like this might appeal to more people. And then I think it relates to some of the questions that just got asked as to, you know, how do you do the similarity? How do you actually have a computational algorithm that can tell you something about similarity of orders? And that's much of the talk. But before that, I want to actually thank Venki, Alex, Anne-Marie, Bob, for both this opportunity and really enjoying myself here. And this wouldn't have started but for Jason Castro being at Pitt, and then just before moving to Bates, getting me involved along with Irvin and Shannon. And the earlier work that I did with Jason, I'm going to make a strong claim, which is that, and I'm happy to take questions on that, which is that the order space, the perceptual space, is categorized into about 10 different things, right? And although this idea is probably not so critical for this talk, but I want to just put that up front. Because, well, when we wrote that paper, most often the question that gets asked is that, oh, how good is that? What does it mean to say that something is fruity? Can you actually tell us what physical chemical properties might be playing a role in, you know, determining these things? So, so we left that question out in the way we wrote that paper, and then we said, well, can they actually predict membership, the physical chemical features? And then I was at a poster session, and Alex came and said, if you think that that's what it is, then I think you should be able to show that your representation is good enough to do this, right? So, and just to impress upon you that when you list out these properties, can you actually get some visual feedback as a picture? So I want to actually show you a picture and say that if, so just before that, forgot to mention, so I'm going to talk a little bit more about this later on, but we were working with some psychophysics data. This was the Drabnik's order profile data, which helped us get there. So, and then we took those monomolecular compounds that was in the database. They turned out to be about 140 of them. And for each one of them, we computed some physicochemical properties. And then for this, we basically did what Alex was suggesting in their paper, which is that be careful with how you normalize, and you know, if they're log normal, do something, if they're negative, do something else. So just so that everybody's on the same page in terms of, you know, how we dictate this. And what I did here was that I'm trying to show you how the physicochemical properties look like. And I also organize them in such a way that these are my 10 categories. We'll talk a lot more about these categories, but if you take category number 3, that's fruity and citrus, and there are about 10 compounds there. Something like garlic, onion, and sulfide, there are 14 compounds. So these white lines here are actually telling you each one of these clusters, right? And then if you look at this, as I said, these are all sort of normalized. And so you have these categories, and you have these physicochemical properties, and you like to build some intuition that indeed, if it is the case that the physicochemical properties can tell you something about their membership, you know, show me something. So here, what I did was that I took two categories. Group 1 is the floral or the fragrant, and then group 4, which is the sickening or putrid. And then I basically said, you know, what is the mean and, you know, the errors or standard deviation there for the group 1 and group 4, and I just plotted them. So not surprisingly, you say that, you know, wherever one's high, the other one's low, and vice versa. It's almost like a mirror image, right? So that tells you a little bit that, look, I mean, in this high-dimensional space, in this case, I only computed about 78 properties here. And you can think of them in these categories, so atom counts, mass and size, partition coefficients, thermodynamic properties, connectivity indices, and so on. So potentially you could have a much larger repertoire of, you know, how you measure this. So here I'm saying if I were to line them all up and then look at these, it looks to me just by your eye that, you know, these things seem different. So then the question is that, well, maybe now I can actually use some machine learning to do something more for us, right? So, and what the machine learning is supposed to do is that I have some perceptual space and I have some categories in the perceptual space. And if I say, well, I know who the members are, and then I painted 3 members, and this whole thing is cartoon just to make the reader appreciate. So, and then what I did here was that I said, look, if I look at the red and green dots, they correspond to 2 different odorants, and they both come in the category of being floral. And then, but if you look at their physicochemical properties, for all I know, in that space, they're actually very far off, right? And then something that's minty, you know, just because of the structure, the substructures being the same, it's closer to an odor that was otherwise floral. Okay? So if I want to be able to use machine learning, what I would like to say is that somehow I should be able to register these two spaces. And then the way I think about registering is basically saying that, you know, just minimize this sort of a cross talk here, so that find an operation, a transformation G, that will let you put both the floral compounds, even though physicochemically that distance is large, close by, because this way you have respected whatever the perceptual space is actually telling you to do. Right? That's it. So then the question was that, how do I actually do this psychophysics? We didn't do it, but by using those prior idea about how you want to define these categories, I can generate that sort of information, and we'll talk at length about this, right? So, and then the idea is that, again, the earliest paper I'll show you, the machine learning is not new, people have used that, but recently it has become very popular to solve problems of this kind. Yesterday we saw a talk on similarity. It may or may not address this problem directly, but the idea is that somehow you should be able to find these distances that respect and that go on to be a metric. And as you know, metric should have some other properties. We'll explain that in just a second. But that's a sort of idea that you could somehow be able to register these two spaces, right? So, and in the big picture, so there are four things here. I would like a metric that will help me recapitulate the psychophysics data. I would like a metric that allows me to compare two odorants, just because I might be interested in electronic nose or something. And then I would like the metric to give me some insight into the dimensionality of the olfaction space, because that's an interesting topic, just we heard. And then I'm also going to touch upon something else, which is that how I could potentially do a very large scale computational sort of studies with these sort of metrics. It doesn't end with the metric. Metric is only telling you about a space in which it respects the perceptual sort of insight that you had. And if I had that space, I should be able to then go on and build a classifier. So these are two different things here. One, you build a metric, and two, you build a classifier. And in building the metric, you're already aware that there's something about these categories, and something is similar and something is dissimilar. Here, I'm just making it explicit because I listed all my 10 categories, and I told you about, you know, see, these are some of the key descriptors for each one of these categories. And this one is actually telling me how many odorants are there. And so let's say I did all the work, and then I say, you know, how well can I actually build this metric and what it can do for me? So here, what I'm trying to show you is that if you were to just scramble the data and build a null model for how you could, you know, potentially build a classifier and categorize into, you know, 10 different things, my accuracy is roughly about 10%. That's like 1 in 10 that I have there, right? And then I like to think that, you know, these the transformation that I'm going to build G fetches me something like 50%. So small data set, small number of categories, but I would like to be able to say that here's a framework that could potentially be useful in, you know, in the studies. Right? So so what we did was that we took Drabik's database. These are the four panels here, and I'm going to take you through each one of them in just a second. So the data matrix A, and the way you should think about it is that these are the, every column here is the 140 or so odorants that I have, and then the number of rows here corresponds to all the descriptors that Drabnik's used in, you know, in rating that odor, okay? And I'm going to do a non-negative matrix factorization, sorry for the acronym, but that's how it's popularly put down. I'm going to rewrite this as basis times some coefficients. So the basis vectors are W, the coefficients are H. This is just out of the box. There's nothing special that we did at this stage, but we worked a lot on trying to determine the dimensionality of the system, and I'm going to take you through that in just a second. So here, so the way you want to interpret is that W is the number of rows here is as many descriptors that you have, and the number of columns here is that low-dimensional space that you're hoping to create. And then the H will be for each odorant, and how many odorants there are. So this is long and thin, and this is thin and wide. Okay. So for any machine learning, as you know, you'll take the data, you'll divide it into training and testing, and then you say, okay, learn this basis vectors for the training and show me what sort of errors you make on the testing. And it turns out, you see that here, the gray line here is for the testing data set and the dark line here is for the training. And I'm also showing these error bars because you don't do it once, but you repeat it many times. And you see that the errors sort of go down both for the training and testing. And then after a while, the training error sort of, the testing error sort of goes up. But the training error after a while goes down, and technically it is supposed to continue this way, right? It's supposed to not go up again. And the issue there, and this is what at least I told the reviewers at the time, is that the way you learn the W and H is that it's an iterative procedure, and then the optimization is nonlinear. So in other words, at the first, it's an iterative loop wherein you say, you know what, I'm going to pretend that W is fixed, go and find H. You just have to compute the pseudo inverse and you get that. And then once you get that, then you'll say, well, it's non-negative, so I'm going to set everything that's negative in H to zero and recompute. Okay. And then once I compute H, then I'll say, okay, H is fixed, I'm going to try and compute W, I'm going to do the pseudo inverse. So each time, you can set this up as a convex problem. But what happens is that as you increase subspace, which is what you're seeing here, and this is the root mean square deviation error on the y-axis, as you increase the subspace, I'm also increasing the dimensionality. And I think given the data, Alan thinks I'm actually doing a good job. So then the question is, well, this picture alone is not telling me, this picture is actually telling me that maybe the dimensionality is more like 20 or 30, right? So then what we had to do is that we had to go take a look at what exactly is happening during the training, which is that what happens is that for about the first 10 basis vectors, so the thing is that when you went from 10 to 11, it's not as if you had 10 and then you take the 11th and introduce a new one. You actually relearn the whole system. So it turns out that for about 10 or 15 or so, those basis vectors are pretty steady. No matter how you learn, they show up to be what they show up to be. But after that, it gets very flaky. It's really picking up noise because there's a lot of singularity in that vector. I'll show you what I meant by the singularity. But then there's a lot of fluctuation there. So that makes you believe that, you know, maybe there are other ways to think about this space in and around 10 and 30, right? So the way what we did for that is, we basically said, okay, as you know, you can't beat PCA in terms of how much variance it can explain for the data. So here on the y-axis is a reconstruction error. So if you had to only use the first PCA basis vector, it's going to do much better than any of those linear representations there. But after a while, about 10 or so, then you see that the errors that both these methods are making tend to be roughly the same. Okay, and then you can, in this plot here, you can ask, well, how much information are you actually gaining every time you add this new dimension? And that gets to be interesting, because then what you can do is that you can take this input data, as you know, there's no null sort of model here, so you go and scramble the input data, and then you ask, if you were to scramble, I'm going to do the PCA on the scrambled the psychophysics data right here, and then I'm going to do exactly the same thing, and I'm going to measure how much is the gain that I get by introducing each extra dimension. There you see that the lines cut somewhere around 10. Okay, so then that made us believe that, so maybe, you know, 10 could be actually a good number there, and then we started, you know, looking at this in more detail. So just for argument's sake, I'm still going to start with panel B. So what I'm showing you here is a waterfall plot of all the 10 basis vectors. So what you're seeing is the order descriptor number. As you know, that should be 140 plus. And these are the basis vectors, so 1, 2, 3, 4, all the way to the 10. And you see that when you look at this stuff, and then I think I'm plotting the first one here. So I took this first guy here, and then I'm replotting it here. And you see that there are a handful of descriptors that have very large amplitude. Okay. And then much of the data is actually very sparse. So I can actually just sort them out, and then I'm plotting here basis vector 1, 2, just a histogram of the values that you're seeing right here. And then I'm asking, you know, what are all the lead descriptors that I can get? It turns out that for basis vector 1, I get fragrant, floral, perfumery. Basis vector 4, for example, sickening, rancid, sweaty, sour, and so on. Okay. So then the question you might say is that, you know, if you're thinking in terms of pleasant and unpleasant, you know, W1 and W4 are actually explaining that. But one thing that NMF is telling me that PCA is not telling me is that there's no reason for me to couple those two, that they could actually be two different pockets that are there. Maybe they're on the same line, but there is some sort of a gap in, you know, how you want to think about this, right? So when it is W1, it's picking up one component, and it's W4, it's picking up some other perceptual sort of a cluster, okay? And in doing so, there's no point in time where you say that the basis vectors are orthogonal. It just turns out that if I look at the inner products and then take a histogram, it turns out that most of them are nearly orthogonal. The first bar here is just a diagonal value, so you can ignore that. And if you ask where the other are close to, you know, pi over 2, okay? So then the question that the reviewers had is that, well, wait a minute, so maybe the sparsity that you're claiming has to do with NMF itself. It's just your representation that you're using that's introducing this sparsity, right? Or that NMF is just an artifact of that, right? So what I wanted to show you here is that I'm going to go back to the input data, and then I'm going to shuffle it. And then I have more than one way to shuffle. I can shuffle it just randomly, or I can shuffle just the rows, or I can shuffle the elements of just the columns. Okay? And in each case, I'm going to go and look at, you know, what sort of sparsity I'm going to get. And it turns out that the gray value here has to do with the original data, and everything else in color are all my shuffling sort of things. This alone may not give you insight, but you might say that, look, something like the green guy seemed to have a lot of sparsity, so, you know, so is that maybe more important, right? And then the green guy came because I shuffled the odorants, and the blue came because I shuffled the descriptors, right? So then what I'm going to do is I'm going to try and build a consensus matrix. So what we're going to do here is that you have the basis vectors, and I have this coefficient matrix H. And for each odorant, I can make an assignment as to where it should belong to, right? And I'll show you that plot in just a second. And if I do that, then I'm going to ask, okay, I'm going to do many, many trials, and I'm going to ask how often odorant A and B show up in the same cluster. And it turns out that sort of a nice blockiness only shows up for the original data, but for any shuffling, those basis vectors, they are really random, and then, you know, they really don't necessarily thinking too much about the data to cluster them, right? So that gives us a little bit more belief that, you know, these sort of representations could be useful, and that they're consistent, and that the sparseness is not just an artifact there, that you could, it's a consequence of the categories, right? So, and then how do I assign something to a category? So I took this H matrix, and then I basically said, reshuffle it, just so that if in that H matrix, so every column here is an odorant, and every row here meant which one of its categories that it belongs to. And you see this very strong block diagonal sort of a feature or property to that matrix. I actually had to shuffle it, just as. But if it is the case it belonged to more than, you know, sort of more than one cluster, I would have seen that here, right? So, but here I just shuffled it. I'm not doing any thresholding. This tells me that, indeed it is the case that I could discretely assign them to each one of these categories, right? And then the last question is that, well, if it is the case, can you show me what compounds fell in these sort of categories and how do they look like? And I just chose something for argument's sake to say that these substructures are the similar, not different from these substructures, but they all are in cluster 2, similarly in cluster 7 here, right? So then the question is that if you had properties like this that are sort of obvious with the system, how can you build some machine learning tools to actually do that for you? So which is that if you knew how to go about thinking about the perceptual space and you have a way of assigning odorants to this perceptual space, can you then find a mapping? I'm going to call this G that allows me to put those odorants into the same category. Okay? So, as I said, this is a very old idea, and then the first paper that I could think of, that I could see, was a 1974 paper, and actually doing multidimensional scaling to do exactly that. In a small data size, on a smaller data set, but there are also, you know, more recent work, and it's been a very popular idea to say, how do you find the perceptual similarity from the odor structure? Okay? So, and then the question is that how do you actually design a distance metric? And then what I'm going to say is that somehow the olfaction system sort of understood as to the space being high dimensional, and it has to accommodate for that, right? And you could go about analyzing this without worrying too much about categories and all. So for example, if you were to do sort of PCA and all, you're saying, well, what could be the most dominant feature here? But as you know, the systems evolve, so just because something is dominant may or may not have, you know, evolutionary need for it. So you want to think a little bit more about how you want to organize the space. And the common way that the distances are put together is that if you had two odorants represented by X and Y here, and that is their physical chemical properties, you could just compute the Euclidean distance, right? And that's a very popular thing to do. Or you could, you know, in the paper here, it basically says, why don't you compute the angle between those two? Right? So, and it turns out, based on, you know, how you want to think about this, you can generalize this, and then you'll say, you know what, actually, I want to be able to compute a distance, and I think I'm interested in applying a transformation that actually respects the sort of constraints that I have, which is that not that there are 10 categories, is that with that knowledge, I can now, if I randomly sample two odorants from the Robbins database, I can tell you whether they belong to a category or not, or whether they're similar or not. That's the only reason why I would use all that computation. But if I had very large amount of psychophysics data, I could have used that. But this formulation, you could use psychophysics data or you could use computational data, nothing to stop you, as long as, you know, you'll say that you're prescribing to this idea of finding a matrix or a metric G that, you know, that you're computing. But this is no surprise if you think about just a little bit of an algebra, it is still computing the Euclidean distance. It's just that it's finding something that's in informative directions in that space, and once you sort of project it down there, you can actually do that, right? So instead of G here, it could have been your principal components of the physical chemical space, or it could have been anything else. Any nonlinear function of these properties could actually go there, right? So that actually sets up a sort of a framework for us to think about how you could design computationally sort of driven similarity, you know, algorithm, right? How do I learn it? But in doing so, I haven't said anything about how you're going to actually incorporate the perceptual stuff, right? So this is the first time where I'm actually going to introduce that. So let's start from there are three things here, and let's start from the bottom. And what the bottom is basically saying is that the G has some properties, okay, that it should be positive, semi-definite. And what it means is that it, as you know, with distance, it has to respect non-negativity, it has to respect if X and Y and X should give you the same distance, if X and Y and Z, that sum should be greater than X and Z, the triangular inequality, and so on. So those properties are sort of being respected if you say that G should be positive semi-definite, except for one thing. It's not really called a metric, but it's called a pseudometric, only because if X and X, if I give you X and Y and the distance is zero, it doesn't necessarily mean that X and Y are the same odorant, right? So that's one thing that you can relax. And what this guy is trying to say is that, look, you have some data. The data is either similar or dissimilar. So you have two sets, large or otherwise, but you have two sets. And then X and Z basically meant they both belong to the similar you know, set. And X and Z here belong to a dissimilar set. Okay, so I used all that categorical thing just so that I can generate this S and D. But if you have psychophysics data, I could have used that here. Okay, and it doesn't have to be categorical. Not S is zero or one. It could have been any other continuous number, and I should be able to do that. Right. So, and then what these two, now, so this constraint is basically saying that, hey, make it sure that it acts like a metric. This one is saying that if you go back to this earlier picture, the first constraint is basically saying that if they both belong to the same category, the distance between them, just reduce the distance between them. And if they belong to different categories, increase the distance between them. It's as simple as that. And it turns out the optimization is also pretty simple. Expensive, but pretty simple. Okay? So to solve this, all we're trying to say is that, and this one is totally arbitrary. It could be any distance that you choose, except that if you choose a distance k, then that gets absorbed into g as a square term. Okay, so that's regardless. And all this is saying is that if you were to give me a g, a matrix, I'm going to compute this. And if that distance that I'm getting over all possible pairs and the similarity are less than that constant, I'm happy. Okay? If it is not the case, it turns out you can just write this out as a linear equation. You're not doing anything more than solving the linear equation and then adjusting the G. Okay? So you repeat this for however long you can or however long is required, saying that every time you correct it, you make sure that this is positive semi-definite. So the expensive part is that, not this part, but this part is because you have to do some eigenvalue decomposition and then get the eigenvalues. If they are negative, set them to zero and then sort of redo them. Okay? So that's only, that's painful, but it's doable with the matrix that I have, which is about 78 by 78. But if I had E dragons sort of properties, which are 3,000 and 4,000, maybe I'll have to worry a little bit about, you know, how I'm actually going to do this. And then there are other relaxations that are numerically much smarter in, you know, how you can do this. Okay. And then what this one is saying is that, oh, okay, so now I have a now that you have converged here, just go back here and then make sure that the distance between the dissimilar guys is as large as possible. So here I'm just going to do a gradient ascent to move them apart. Okay? And every time I move these guys, I'll say, oh, G changed. I'm going to come inside here, come and then fix these. And then once I fix this, I go back here, and then I change, and then I keep moving till I cannot move anymore. Okay? And then it turns out every stage of this process, you can, you know, show that it is convex and that you can do a, you know, have a solution that's not stuck in a local minimum. Okay? There's one last thing I want to mention here, is that here, I'm squaring it, but here I'm not squaring it. So if you have a question on that, you know, we can talk more. But that's a difference, and that's very, actually very crucial for how these algorithms work, that here it's a, if you, since I already defined this as a distance, I'm going to call this a square root of the distance. So the square root of the distance is being used here in separating out, but the square of the distance is being used to bring them all together. Okay, so for this data set, which is that given I have these categories and I have the orderings and all, I can generate the S and D out of this data set. Okay? And given these numbers, I get S for about, I get about 1,000 pairs, and the dissimilar guys, I get about 17K or so. Okay? And that's important.
You may, yeah. Similar means they're in the same.
They are similar in the case.
Similar in different.
Dissimilar means they're in different categories. So you might say, well, how much of psychophysics will it be? I'll come to that, and there's a slide to actually take us through a little bit of that. Okay? So that's it. So given this, I'm going to actually learn it. And the way I did it is that I know it's not visible, and I didn't have the time to actually correct this. But this, I know the starting value for G is just a diagonal matrix. Everything else is zero. And then, you know, a small number of iterations, all the couplings sort of emerge. The size here is basically 78 by 78. That basically tells you what physical chemical properties are talking to what other physical chemical properties. And G is basically saying that, okay, that kind of coupling will help me sort of satisfy the perceptual conditions that you have, constraints that you have put in. And I like to think that, you know, once this is converged, that, you know, this sort of a tool would actually be useful for classification. So just to show you, you know, what it did in that, yeah, sorry, question? And then just to convince myself that it's actually doing useful, this is the projection of all these features on the eigenvectors of the metric G that I learned. And then if the stripes are of the same color, that means they belong to the same category. And this is the projection on the PCA vectors. Just in the interest of time, and because I only have 3 minutes, I'm going to quickly go through a few things, but hopefully we'll have time to cover that. Okay, so the first row here is basically saying, if you were to put a classifier, and I took off-the-shelf SVM kind of stuff, and project the original data onto these informative directions, and then use that for classification, and then do all the ML that I needed to do to get this right, it turns out that I'm getting an accuracy of 52. If I were to only use a small number of eigenvectors, I still get a large, the small number being 6. If I were to use the eigenvectors of the physical chemical space and project the data in there, you know, that's the sort of number I get. And then this is just a random model that you have seen. This we'll talk later. Okay, this is just to show you that the metric and the PCA, what the difference, why bother doing all this, why don't you just use the eigenvectors, be done with it. This is just to show you that a small number of eigenvectors of the metric, of the G, not the physical chemical space, which is the PCA here, will fetch you a good accuracy. And this is the confusion matrices, and in each case you'll see that there's something about category 6 that I actually don't do very well. But given all this, given that setup G, I can go back and ask which one of these properties is actually playing a role. So I'm going to compute what is called the R score. So imagine that I'm actually going to go nuke the elements in the G and then recompute that energy or the distance term. And then I'm going to ask how much it changed and do some more numerical stuff around it. Then come back with an R score, just like the Z score. And that tells you which one of these feature properties are actually causing or are being important for any one of these categories. So here, so for example, for each one of these categories, these numbers basically meant what the compounds are in the Drabnik's database, and then it tells you, you know, what are all the properties that show up. It turns out that thermodynamics is very important, given the feature set that I have taken, the thermodynamic properties, and then also the intuitive molecular indices, chemical intuitive molecular indices also turn out to be the same. And we also played with actually just explicitly letting the machine learning algorithms tell us what features are important. I have some statistics there. Or if you want to gain more intuition, I'm just going to say, you know what, redo the whole thing without the atomic count, redo the whole thing without the thermodynamics. So I have some insight there, and then I also have some insight as to, you know, why the coupling is playing a role. So in this case here, the CIM indices and the thermodynamics are sort of coupled. And the last slide, which is to say that how much data do you really need? And it turns out that I can throw away 75% of the data. I'll tell you some numbers there. You know, I get some accuracy that's still sort of reasonable. And then in terms of dimensionality, the intrinsic dimensionality, it turns out anywhere between 10 and 15, even if I ignore the categories and I sweep through every possible number that I can think of, which is 1 to 25, 2 to 25, I get that. So, and the last slide is just to let you know that these are all fraction spaces. I could do some large-scale computational studies. So that's my summary. Thank you so much.
You showed one of the earlier slides when where the that indicated the dimensionality is around 10 or 20. And I wonder whether that's a function of the data set size.
So I wish I had bigger data set sizes, and that's the best I have. So if you have pointers to where I can get larger data sets, that'll be fantastic.
Well,
Aaron, this
you
is could order
go
profile
smaller,
data.
Smaller, right? You
Sorry?
Could say, suppose you reduced, like you said, would the.
So with the training and testing, I'm already working with something smaller.
Yeah, that's right. But, yeah.
I guess the question, I mean, it's an impressive idea to compute the distance matrix G. I mean, I guess the question whether you tried it on to separate testing and training set and see if the distances in the training set correlate with, well, the distances to compute in the training set correlate with the testing set.
So, I'll try and give a long answer, and I don't know if I'll answer that exactly. So you might say, you know, I'm using all the odorants and computing G. And when it came to classification, I'm saying, oh, I'm going to do this training and testing. So I had to go back and rethink about this, right? So what we did was that, which is why the downsampling came. It said if I had to only have a small subset of data, can I build the G and actually show you that the classification is something sort of useful? So in the version of the paper that we submitted, that's what we wrote. We basically said that, look, you could throw away 75% of the data, you get accuracies about 46%. So then I was very careful as well, which is that when I threw away the 75%, and I'm only working on the 25% data, so I learned G. And then I also learn the classifier, and then apply it on this remaining set. So I think I had some combinations there that I had to try to convince myself that I'm actually doing an okay job with the machine learning. I don't know if that answers your question, but I had to go through that to get this right. Yeah.
So have you tried this on any external validation data to validate that this is working?
No, not in the version so far that I have. Are there data sets that I should
be so have you? Are you aware of the Dream Olfaction Challenge where they posted 500 odors? And?
No, actually we participated. So, but I don't know if I'm allowed to actually use it outside the competition until October, November or something like that, if I remember. So I'm not allowed to use it outside of the competition.
So maybe this is a question as much for everybody else as for you, but Do we actually know whether our perceptions are metric? Because there's an old cognitive literature which focuses on our particularly when we categorize, in places where we categorize, that our perception is very strongly non-metric. So, you know, things are much more similar to the prototypes of their categories than the prototype of the category is to the outlier, right? I don't know. Turkeys are more similar to starlings than starlings are to turkeys, because starlings are a prototypical bird and turkeys not.
Right.
So I was wondering whether with odors you get to that. I mean, obviously, if I do very simple geometrical rearrangements in an image, then it will be metric. But somehow, if I get to something that's sufficiently abstract, then it stops being metric. So I was wondering where odors were on that.
I think the audience will have better answer than I do.
Okay.
Chakra?
Yeah.
So you said that this is there in the non-negative matrix factorization, the published stuff. So you chose to sort of have these guys non-negative. And isn't that the reason why you got sort of two separate axes for pleasantness and unpleasantness?
Yeah.
But you said that, no, there may be something actually different. So now it makes me wonder, can an odor belong to both categories?
So one of the plots, what I was trying to say here in that plot.
You show that it doesn't, but I'm just wondering if it's hidden somewhere in the wash.
Yeah, so unless it's a mixture, these are all monomolecular compounds, but if there is a mixture, you would imagine it being somewhere in the middle, for example, or somewhere else. So, but I'm not doing learning on that sort of a data set.
Other questions? This gets a little bit technical, but it's actually been shown that different NMF algorithms yield drastically different quality of solutions. Did you try multiple algorithms?
No. We did a lot of that. And as you know, while I just said this is how the algorithm works, and there's a noise model that you could invoke in a Poisson, and you know all that. And for each one of these noise models, you want the algorithm to actually adapt to that noise model. But in this case, I think I tried a bunch of them. Explicitly putting sparsity and all that. But I think the results are pretty robust, for sure, with this data set. Mm-hmm. Again, I'm limited to this data set.
Yeah. Any other questions? If not, let's thank the speaker again.
Thank you.
I think we have a coffee break. What time, Anne-Marie, what time do we come back?
Back at 4:00.
Okay, back at 4:00.